Welcome to Occult of Personality at occultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Occult of Personality, esoteric podcast extraordinaire. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and you can find our website at occultofpersonality.net, featuring an extensive archive of recorded interviews. Occult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the Occult of Personality membership section. Membership provides access to a tremendous archive of interviews for a low monthly fee while helping to support the production and distribution of the show. Please consider subscribing if you haven't already. This episode is also made possible by additional donations from Steve, as well as an anonymous donor. Thanks again. Occult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. Now, in episode number 141, our guest is James Robert French. James has been studying and practicing magic and paganism for 18 years. He is an initiate and a leader of the Open Source Order of the Golden Dawn, and an initiate of Ordo Templi Orientis, as well as a novice priest in the Ecclesia Gnostica Catholica. His first novel, Lady Midnight, is published by Concrescent Letters, and you can find his blog, Strange Onion Peelings, at jamesrfrench.wordpress.com. Lady Midnight is not your typical occult fiction. Yes, it's written by an initiate and a mage, but the plot contains elements of radical politics and esotericism that are undeniably intriguing. It is a page-turner that hooked me from the start with its mix of politics, magic, over-the-top characters, and violence. Lady Midnight is a thriller from beginning to end, and if you're looking for a dose of modern occult fiction, check it out. As James says, Lady Midnight is a different take on the occult fiction genre. Darker, edgier, more character-oriented. Moral ambiguity abounds. There is no Dr. Taverner here. James Robert French, I want to welcome you to Occult of Personality podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Love is the law, love under will. And I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. Recently, your first novel was published, Lady Midnight, by Concrescent Letters. Before we talk about the book, I'd also like to hear a little bit about your background and bio.
Mainly focusing on how I got into this weird magic business?
Mainly.
Okay. Well, I was raised in what was a fairly mainstream kind of evangelical family, and departed from that. It started kind of early. And then when I became a teenager, it really stopped working for me. Mm-hmm. I drifted into meditation, some new agey kind of thinking, briefly looked at shamanism, and finally settled on Wicca, actually, was where I started. I was a teenage witch. did that for several years before I started realizing that I was drifting towards Hermeticism and the Kabbalah, Golden Dawn-ish types, magic, and particularly Aleister Crowley and Thelema. I was lucky enough to find a group in the Bay Area that had just started up called the Open Source Order of the Golden Dawn that seemed to be doing everything that I was interested in. So in September of 2002, excuse me, it would have been August of 2002 that I was actually initiated. I took my neophyte with them, and I've been mingling with them ever since.
Excellent. Could, for people who aren't aware, could you talk just a little bit about the Open Source Order of the Golden Dawn, what distinguishes it from other Golden Dawn organizations, and a little, maybe just a little bit of the history of it?
It was founded by Sam Webster, actually a year before I joined, a year and some change, out of a workshop he gave at PantheaCon called something to the effect of, this is ceremonial magic, not that. Because he was trying to distinguish things like the Goetia or just kind of hermetic ritual from actual ceremonial magic as we do it in the Golden Dawn. Meaning, you know, full, formal, slow. You know, a lot of people find the Golden Dawn very slow. That's one comment I get a lot. It's so slow and long. That sort of ritual, full ritual with tons of people and lots of wands and swords and robes. After the workshop, he asked a bunch of people. He asked the people who had been there, because he'd actually opened the Hall of Neophytes in the traditional Golden Dawn form. He asked the people who had done that if, you know, if they wanted to do anything further, he would open up his home a few weeks later, and my understanding is about 17 people showed up.
Wow.
At his house. And so that was the genesis. And the main difference between the Open Source Order of the Golden Dawn and the traditional Golden Dawn is we don't use much, if any, of the original Judeo-Christian symbolism. We have taken that out and put in mostly Thelema and updated some of the Egyptology, because the original Golden Dawn was working from Budge. Budge was really good in the 1890s, but for, you know, 2002, he just didn't work anymore.
Yeah.
And rather than having Osiris as our Hierophant, as the traditional Golden Dawn would have, we have Horus in the form of Rahorquit, form of Horus from the Book of the Law, sometimes also called Rahorakti, Ra, Horus of the Horizon. And in the West, we have, in what would be Horus the Elder's position, excuse me, not Horus the Elder, just Horus, we have Set,
mm-hmm.
which really freaks some people out.
Interesting. So where does the open source label play into this?
The thinking behind it is that, partly derived from Sam's own thinking on open source religion, which I'm not entirely conversant with that aspect of his work, mm-hmm. but in terms of the Golden Dawn, the general idea is that the cipher manuscript, which is the outlines of the rituals, and they're very sparse.
Right.
Most of what we think of as the Golden Dawn is not in them. Most of what people think of as the Golden Dawn is what Mathers and Samuel MacGregor Mathers and William Westcott and their associates built onto the scaffolding of a manuscript that the best information we have now came out of the papers of a Freemason and member of the SRAA, or a Rosicrucian society in England. After he died, they inherited some papers from him, and among them were the cipher manuscripts for rituals. They're written in code. They're outlines that probably Mackenzie was preparing. They're clear elaborations of some SRAA rituals that you can find in various places online. And they built on that outline for the rituals.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that that manuscript constitutes a source code, and that since it has been published for well over 100 years now, there is absolutely no justification in keeping it secret.
Mm.
That's one of the other differences. We don't have any oaths of secrecy vis-a-vis magic or anything about what we do, with the exception of some things in what's called the Second Order.
Okay.
There are some things that we don't generally share.
That makes sense. Now, is there any form of obligation for new members at all? Or is it that simply not part of the neophyte ritual?
The oath of the neophyte is, so with my all, I have no right but do my will. I shall do that, and no other shall say nay. For true will, unassuaged of purpose, delivered from the lust of result, is every way perfect. Which, of course, comes from the Book of the Law.
Yeah, that's a much more succinct obligation.
It is.
In the past several years, it seems like there's a lot of conflict and acrimony between various Golden Dawn groups and their supporters and devotees. And I don't really notice any of that going on with the open source order, the Golden Dawn. Maybe these distinguishing characteristics are enough to separate the open source order, the Golden Dawn, from a lot of the other more traditional or standard Golden Dawn type of groups.
We have generally kept our distance from that, with the exception of right when we first got started. We had a number of individuals with some complaints about the changes we made, such as, you know, including Seth at all, and these sorts of issues. And generally speaking, we've stuck around by only engaging them at the level of fact. In other words, not actually going after persons and basically not letting one side of the various conflicts pull us in their direction. We basically said, we're going to do our thing. You can do your thing. And there's no reason why we can't coexist. Because really, this is a very, very small pond.
Well, thank you for sharing your thoughts about that. So we should turn to your book, Lady Midnight, which is your first novel, is that correct?
Yes.
Curious about your background in writing fiction. Have you been at it for a long time?
Well, I wrote my first short story, Memory Serves, when I was about 5. I mean, it wasn't more than a page. I mean, I obviously don't have it anymore, and I don't really remember what it was about. But I've always wanted to write or do something that involved a story in general. I liked coming up with stories and entering other worlds and creating them in my mind and sharing them with other people. I've been I won't say I've been diligent about it all my life. I have this cyclical pattern with my writing. I'll go through long periods of gestation and then bursts of activity. For the past few years, I've been generally steady in writing at least a couple short pieces a month. And the way Lady Midnight came around was basically I knew that Sam Webster had a press, obviously. He had started his own small press, and he put out a few books by the time I approached him and asked him, would you be interested in doing fiction? And he said, maybe. Send me the first chapter. So I typed out the first chapter, sent it to him, and he liked it. And by the time I had sent him chapter 3, he was saying, where's my next chapter? I want to finish my book. It was that kind of thing. So, which is actually the exact opposite way of the way you're supposed to write a book. You're supposed to do the first draft absolutely isolated from everyone, and then only share it when the first draft is done. But I've never really cared about rules, so.
Well, it is certainly what I would consider a page-turner. I mean, it is an exciting read. Could you talk a little bit about the basic gist of the story?
Basically, it's about a woman. I mean, there are a lot of characters, but to me, it was always about the central female character, Andrea Styx, who belongs to an organization that uses occult means to undermine the capitalist system by conducting basically magical attacks against corporations. And protege comes into her life that is connected with her past and makes her doubt the direction her life has taken with this organization. And she comes up with a plan of sorts to get away by undertaking an operation to get enough money to become independent. And the plan goes horribly sideways, and things kind of get worse from there for her.
The whole concept of the agency that you came up with for the book, I think, is really quite interesting. Could you talk a little bit about the idea behind it and sort of where that comes from and other relevant details? I mean, it seems to me like this was a important point in the book, and maybe there's some real-world implications of it.
It's always hard to say where I get ideas from. I've always been obviously into things like secret societies and also espionage types of organizations, just because I find the intrigue intellectually interesting. And I sat down with this really general idea in my head and ran with it, and it came together as the agency. And to me, it was both something that part of me would like to see happen, but also I can see the limitations of it, knowing I've been around, you know, sort of radical and progressive politics for a while, long enough to have seen the shortcomings of it. So to me, it was a way of talking about radical and progressive politics that didn't require me to state outright in a way that would have sounded like I was finally condemning something that I didn't necessarily, that I not even don't necessarily want to, I don't want to condemn, but that I see as problematic on a number of levels. I find the approach that a lot of radical groups take actually counterproductive, because obviously the world has not become a less violent, more just place in the past 50 years that radical politics has really heated up. In fact, it seems to be getting worse.
Yeah, I was just going to say, one of the things I thought was interesting is the way that you brought this radical politics and these ideas into sort of this occult milieu. And I'm curious about your thoughts in general about esotericism or people that are interested in these subjects. Do you think there is a need, or would you like to see more interest in, I don't even know if I would use the word radical politics, but maybe like more concern with social justice or that type of thing within the esoteric community? Or is there enough concern or work in that regard that's maybe already going on behind the scenes?
It's tricky, because when you're dealing with any form of spiritual growth, you're going to be dealing with changes in yourself. And that should include being able to critically examine political ideas, in my opinion, because that's part of your life. And the way you approach politics is a microcosm for the way you approach life. I would like to see more thinking about how spirituality and politics relate to each other, but I'm not sure that I would like to see organizations or individuals within them taking up agendas, because these people are changing themselves, and it's really hard to have a commitment to an ideology if you're honestly making changes in your psyche. Because when you start, you might have one understanding of the world, and when you're done, it might be completely different. And this ideology that you've committed to yourself to may seem completely wrong from the aspect of your own development by the time you're done. And also, politics is kind of, I think a lot of, most people listening to this podcast would generally be familiar with the Eighth Circuit Model of Consciousness from Timothy Leary and popularized by Robert Anton Wilson. Politics is really a Second Circuit territorial kind of thing. And to a large extent, I think dragging down spiritual practices, which should be Fifth Circuit and above, into that realm, you know, in other words, letting the politics guide the magic, which a lot of neo-pagan groups frankly do. They seem to be constructed entirely around political ideology. To me, dragging that far down the circuits hampers it and leads to a lot of ego inflation type problems, where you basically think that your political agenda is in fact handed down, that it's actual wisdom, right, as opposed to thoughts that you have in your head.
This type of issue, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it somewhat sort of comes out in the novel in terms of the leadership of the agency. Is that right?
Are you thinking specifically of what are referred to as the Five?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
And I don't want to give too much away, so.
Right. And we never meet them, of course. I was thinking of them as sort of almost like the agency's secret chiefs or something like that.
That's definitely how it comes across, I think.
And the idea is that they're kind of isolated from the rest of the organization. Only a few people ever talk to them. And they're the only people who are allowed to interact with the agency's egregore, or the general thought form of the agency. And it's a problem for the agency, has made it somewhat static and has kept it in a mode that may or may not be the best mode for it to be in anymore. Because it no longer needs the money that it obtains from the various crimes that it helps people commit. It no longer needs that money. The description of the facilities makes it clear that they are at least as wealthy as a moderately large corporation. Basically, they're still acting as if they're in what the OTO would call battlefield conditions.
Yeah.
Where they still need to fight for their survival, and they don't.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating the way you explored this in the novel, while at the same time, obviously, the ideas that you just talked about in terms of politics and esotericism coming together, it never ceases to interest me, the way these things kind of coalesce. And I don't know if that's just because, I guess you could look at it in a number of different ways, obviously the Eighth Circuit model, but in general, I think there's an aspect to magic and politics, and it seems like that intersection point is like this personal power or organizational power that people seem to want to cultivate.
And it always seems to fall into extremes. The original Golden Dawn was actually fairly left-wing. in their politics, the membership generally. There were members of the IRA. There were early kind of proto-feminists in it. Florence Farr, certainly. Maud Gonne was in the IRA, the Irish Republican Army. I believe that's true. If it's not, someone will correct me in the comments with great...
Hopefully with
great
some,
derision.
Yeah, hopefully with some civility there.
And the Golden Dawn was the first organization, or one of the first organizations to admit men and women on an equal basis. And this sort of continued over into Crowley. He's a bit ambiguous politically. There are aspects of him that are almost anarchistic, and there are aspects of his writings that you could read as almost fascist, and it's always a thorny issue when you start talking about Crowley's politics, because there are people who take him up as the standard bearer of what they think. And I'm usually never convinced by that. Just because much of the time they seem to be back projecting a lot of things that they know now onto his work. And of course he was also a spy for the British government during World War I. He wrote articles for a magazine called The Fatherland, which was a German propaganda magazine. The general idea was make the Germans look so bad that people will turn away from them, kind of thing.
In the past, we were provided with very one-dimensional characters. While they serve their purpose in literature, maybe weren't believable as people that we would interact with in our lives. Whereas the characters in your book, Lady Midnight, seem far more believable, multidimensional, and well thought out in comparison with some of these other works that you're criticizing. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you see as the problem with Dr. Taverner and how you've tried to address that.
I do want it to be understood that the problem is more with that type of story than the specific creation of Dionne Fortune. Because I think she did that really well. Her Dr. Taverner is still the best example of the Dr. Taverner type character. My problem is the repetition of that character, which, as good as it was, wasn't her best work, and certainly wasn't her best character. And Vivian Le Fay Morgan in The Sea Priestess and Moon Magic is much closer to the kind of character I would want to see in a book than Dr. Taverner these days. The Dr. Taverner archetype to me seems like someone who is absolutely morally right, knows it, comes into a situation where weird things are going on, knows exactly what's happening, knows how to solve it, and solves it. And there's no suspense involved, really. And they're almost like fables. Kind of not even that good.
Now, obviously, you've got some specific books or authors in mind when you're talking about these descendants of Dr. Taverner. I don't want to ask you to name names, but I've got one in mind that I specifically read and actually did a show for the podcast on. It really came to mind when I read your article. And I'm not sure if you're necessarily thinking of the same one I am, but there's probably more than a few out there.
If it's the one I think you're referring to, yes, actually.
Okay.
That was one of the more recent examples I had thought of.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Because that certainly came right to the forefront of my mind when I read the article. Not that I didn't enjoy the book or the character in the book, but it certainly, your criticisms, I think, ring true. You know, again, not to say it wasn't enjoyable, but, well, it's hard to, when I start criticizing other people's creative work, right. But I do see your point, and I think it's worth consideration and discussion. If for nothing else, then maybe it will influence authors in the future.
Like I said in the article, I don't even necessarily think, well, I'm not really advocating that anyone do anything. I'm just giving an opinion. Mm-hmm. You know, people can write whatever kind of story they want to. But I do think that if people are going to do that kind of story, they should invest some time in giving the characters some flaws and some points where he could, in fact, be wrong. Or he could, in fact, screw up and someone could get hurt, or even they could get hurt or die. And, like, they need to have potentially fatal flaws. Because that's really where a story comes from, is a character being put in a place where their fatal flaw almost becomes literally fatal. Or they cause other people to be put in that position. Or something. To me, that's where drama comes from.
There's always been fiction that deals with these subjects, but it seems like there's not as much fiction dealing with esoteric subjects. It's actually written by people who are practitioners or at least knowledgeable on the subject, even if they don't practice themselves. And it seems like lately, in the past few years, there's been a, maybe not surge is too general a word, but it seems like there's a number of these type of works that have come to my attention written by people who, in my opinion, are more qualified to write them, and provides the fiction with at least a more firm foundation on the esoteric part of the story. And obviously Lady Midnight falls into that category as well.
I think it's generally a good thing. You know, we do have to remember Sturgeon's Law. You know, that 99% of everything is crap. And so the more material that's out there, the more it's not going to be very good. And I do think that cream rises to the top. I think there's been an upsurge lately because I think there's more interest in the occult now than there was when I was younger. I mean, it goes in waves, but I think that particularly the sort of Western hermetics type of magic has become much more popular in the past few years. I've recently become involved with an OTO body in Oakland, and there are more young people coming in all the time than I would have expected to be interested in something as old and not as apparently accessible as maybe the various neo-pagan stuff would be. A lot of people who are writing now are, like me, they got their first fix with, you know, Dion Fortune, maybe some of Crowley's fiction, but probably mostly Dion Fortune. And people who are into these things are readers, and eventually someone who's reading this stuff is going to say, hey, I could write that. You know, it'd be fun to write that. And it's much easier to publish now than it has been before, especially with things like ebooks, where basically anybody can put an ebook on Amazon and get a fairly decent return back until that bubble bursts.
Well, I guess it seems like Open Source Order of the Golden Dawn, being a Thelemic organization in the OTO, there's naturally some affinity there, but I'm just curious on your own thoughts about the sort of mixing and matching traditions.
in some ways, for me, it's kind of a complementary thing because of the way that OSOGD approaches things. It tends to be more focused on the more I would almost say feminine, but I don't mean that. Nui. It's more focused on Nui.
Mm-hmm.
The openness, the, you know, the space. And for me, the OTO with its focus on, you know, the more solar phallic aspect balances that out.
I'm always curious about how other people sort of reconcile those differences and are able to, you know, gain a lot, I think, from their experiences and being open enough to be part of different esoteric currents, I guess is how I would put it. So I think that's interesting.
I've been attending Gnostic Mass with various iterations of this body. Right now, the name is Blazing Star Oasis. It's been called other things before when I was coming around. And I've been involved with them for a while on some level, just attending Mass. But I did wait until I was done with getting my Adeptus Minor in OSOGD before getting really involved with them, and also when I had fewer responsibilities with OSOGD, just so that it wasn't, you know, just so I wasn't taking one initiation while I was going through another process, and also so that one didn't overwhelm the other.
Now, I noticed that you're already either working on a sequel to Lady Midnight, or maybe you've completed it at this point. Is that right?
Working on, yes. And I'm still kind of working out the details of what that's about.
Okay.
I'm a really intuitive writer. Mm-hmm. I don't do a lot of planning when I start. I tend to, you know, write, and in the course of writing, when I'm doing something else, I'll, you know, kind of think through a scene and visualize it as if I were watching a movie of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, basically when I get home, I'll type out what I saw in my head. So I don't, the sequel is still in formative stages. I had at one point about 40,000 words in and realized that it was going nowhere. I had just fallen in love with, you know, sitting around watching these characters interact, and there wasn't a whole lot of story yet.
Okay.
So I had to go back and start over. So it's a somewhat, a sequel is a somewhat different process that I haven't done before.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to think about, you know, okay, what things do I need to remember from the first book? You know, what themes do I want to cross over and develop further? What new themes do I want to bring in? And how am I going to fit all this mess together?
Right.
Because there are a lot of tricky balances when you're doing occult fiction. Because you have to say enough that someone who knows nothing can follow it, more or less. Or at least if they get confused, it's not terminally confused. And, you know, but you also don't want it to be, like, really dumbed down. And you're also trying to tell a good story. And in my case, you're also trying to deal with all this other, you know, political and these other political and philosophical ideas. So it's a really tricky balance fitting all that together. And then doing that with a sequel, you know, is a second challenge on top of the original challenge.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm familiar with writing nonfiction and research and that type of thing. But to me, writing fiction just seems like a whole different animal. it's so much more involved. And I'm sure people
have... Yeah, but you don't have to worry about facts.
Well, you don't, but at the same time, as you just mentioned, you've got all these other things to sort of keep straight and make sure that the plot moves in the right way and all the characters are developing. To me, the comparison of like going into a book and researching facts and pulling out facts is almost simplistic in comparison to the like the symphony that's going on in a novel. I've tried to write fiction myself, and I guess the bottom line is I enjoy reading it more than writing it. So I appreciate authors like yourself who are able to do it well.
Thank you. Of course, I tend to enjoy writing more than reading, actually. I mean, I like to read, obviously, but I'm actually more influenced by film.
To me, that kind of comes across in your writing because it invokes very strong visual scenes. Your descriptions, I think, are, I don't want to say focused on the visual over other aspects, but you definitely provide like a very rich visual depiction of the characters and the action in the story. So to hear you say that, it definitely fits in, I think, with the way you write. One of the things I like about the dialogue is it seems more real to me, aside from the fact that the story is something that most people would never, ever encounter. But the dialogue itself, the way people speak and convey their thoughts and ideas definitely seems more realistic to me than a lot of other occult novels that I've read.
I think I can thank both Stephen King and Elmore Leonard for that. Because I've been really influenced by their stuff in writing.
Two of the best, I guess, right?
Yeah. The basic rule is keep it short and simple and remember that people don't go off into monologues most of the time.
I'm assuming you read that book by Stephen King about writing itself.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. Obviously, Stephen King is one of the all-time great fiction writers, but for anyone who is looking to write themselves, he wrote a book, I think it's called On Writing.
Uh-huh.
And that book, which he talks a lot about his own story, how he became a writer, and I found that really, really interesting. I definitely would recommend that to people, especially if they are looking to become a writer. But
oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I periodically refer to some of his, like, to sections in it when I'm stuck, actually.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things I really took away from that book, his method for success, which was really to just keep writing and not stop and do it over and over again all the time. It really reinforces the same lessons. Well, I guess anything in life, if you want to be successful at it, you need to practice, do it over and over again, and not give up. That lesson is prevalent in most good books on esotericism and magic. There's been a lot of people who have tried to instill that in their students. Obviously, Crowley, I think. Paul Foster Case comes to mind, whose motto is Preserventia, and was a student of Crowley, at least at one point in his life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, again, you know, like I was saying earlier, any area of your life is a microcosm for other areas of your life. You know, they're going to mirror each other. And yeah, if you want to get anywhere in magic, you have to do stuff every day. You have to do the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram, even though you're sick of it. Still need to meditate. You need to try not to get so wasted that you can't come home and sit, which is a discipline in and of itself. And, you know, to write, you have to sit down and just keep writing, even when you know that what you're pounding out, you're going to have to throw away later. Delivering yourself from lust of result is difficult. Yeah, I generally find that it's best to just go with the process of it and worry about what it looks like when you're done.
Now, I know we have more than a few aspiring or even published authors of fiction who are listening to you in this interview, and I'm curious if you have any advice for people who might be interested in becoming a professional writer or at least in writing a book.
Don't quit your day job. Mm-hmm. Really. I mean, generally speaking, writers don't make a living from writing these days. And I mean, it's possible with ebooks to make a ton of money, but you know, you can't count on it. But also, network. In other words, get to know people who can actually help you get into print. Mm-hmm. Because the slush pile, you know, it's, you need to take the oath of the abyss before you send something into the slush pile. Mm. Because therein lies madness and terror. You will wait forever to hear back from people, and they will tell you no.
Yeah.
Like, look for the path of least resistance to get your work into print. If you decide to self-publish, make sure a few other people look at it.
Right.
Because I have seen people self-published, and it was like, yes, you're charging people money for an unedited rough draft.
Ouch. Yeah.
That's not okay. You can't do that to people.
No, that's not right.
So, you know, with self-publishing, make sure you have people you trust, you know, will do it, who will be good about getting it back to you before next year. Mostly, rather than focus on trying to write a particular kind of fiction, write the story that seems like it will express what you want to express. And you can use, you know, different aspects of genres to get that across. But don't worry about sticking to one thing or another, or writing, you know, one type of character or another. Like, in other words, don't write about, if you write about a policeman, don't write about a policeman. Write about a human being who also happens to be a cop. Yeah, that's one aspect of his life.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a person there beyond, you know, the stereotypical set of stuff you think of when you think of cop. In other words, write about people, not about roles or archetypes. You know, we want to engage with something that, you know, might actually give us some insight into what's going on in the world around us.
You know, we can never have too much of that. Well, James, it's really been a pleasure speaking with you. And I appreciate your book, Lady Midnight, again, published by Concrescent Letters. I'd recommend it to anyone who's interested in occult fiction. I think they would enjoy it. And there's, as we mentioned in the conversation, there's a lot of aspects to the story that I think are not just enjoyable, but really interesting and can make people think about different things, politics, philosophy, business, just in general, the way the world works, and in addition to being a good story.